predictable.
Thanks. Thank you for being here. I've got a couple of disclaimers. I also told Arnold I'm going to be shamelessly self-promoting here. First of all, I have Parkinson's disease, so if I have trouble speaking or if I shake, don't worry, I'm okay. It's just who I am. That's right, thanks. The other thing is, I wanted, we have a Center for Science and Religion down in Sanford. We started in 2009. It's approved by the Board of Trustees. It was founded by a Baptist, a Methodist, a Presbyterian, and a Catholic, with four founding members. And we've been very successful at getting grants. And so I wanted to mention something about that. This project, I'm obliged to say, was funded by the Templeton Foundation. It's a two-year project. We're halfway through. We'll be finished next summer. This summer, last summer, which this work is based on, we had three students working with us over the summer on the research, and this summer we have six students working with us. So Nick and Jason are both students. Nick's now working on a graduate degree in computer science. Steve Donaldson is, there are three principal investigators in this study. One is myself, I'm a statistician. Steve Donaldson is a computer scientist, or I think of him more as a cognitive scientist, a student of artificial intelligence as well as the real brain. And we have a third member that we hired and brought him down from Kentucky, Josh Reeves, who is a theologian interested in science and religion. So there are three principal investigators, and we have a bunch of consultants, theoretical mathematicians, biologists, and so on, helping us with certain aspects of this project. I mention this because, and here's where I'm going to be really shameless. We have a new grant starting in August, next month, another two-year project. And we're hiring a visiting professor of science and religion for the 15-16 year, in the fall of 15. If you or anybody you know is interested in that, we'll be advertising it soon, but if you or anybody you know is interested in that, send me an email, send me a note, and we'll add you to the list that we're okay? What is this all about? Well, I know everybody in here is probably familiar with the late Stephen Jay Gould, and he said this many different ways. This is one of the quotes. We want to know why we're here. To a large extent, it is grand scale accident that we're here. Evolution has oddly contingent pathways, and we never run the same way twice. If you could go back 500 million years and run the tape of life again, you wouldn't get human beings, and you probably wouldn't get anything conscious. And he was pretty well known. More people knew him because of that sentiment than knew him for any other reason. More recently, you may know these or not know them. Bobby Lanowitz and Stuart Kaufman have asked the question, is the biosphere underdetermined by natural law? That is, are the universal physical laws insufficient to account for the evolution of the universe? If you haven't read this book by Lanowitz called A Third Window, I really recommend it. It's sort of cutting edge thinking about natural selection and random mutation is not enough to explain evolution. And they make a very compelling point. Kaufman's out at the Santa Fe Institute in the States. He's been working on self-organization and things like that for quite a while. Even Karl Popper, the last thing he published, I believe it's the last thing he published, The Philosopher of Science, was a writing on propensities. He made the argument late in his life that cause and effect was too stringent a standard to hold the world to. That at best, we had to talk not about cause and effect, but propensities, which as a statistician sort of resonates with me, because that basically boils down to effects are probabilistic, not necessarily determined. And finally, you may know Simon Conway Morris, who has promoted this idea of convergence and has some pretty compelling evidence again that you may end up at the same place, but start and follow different paths in evolution to get there. But you all ultimately end up with the same result. These are the ones that have sort of inspired us to put this grant together and do this work. I already mentioned that. One of the things that really bothered me, I was a medical biostatistician at an academic center in Birmingham, UAB. And I got interested in science and religion after a plane crash in our city, and the guy who spent, there was only two survivors, and one of them spent 4 months in the hospital, and he came out and spoke at our church one night. And he turned him from a theist into a deist, basically, the experience. He no longer believed in a hands-on God, if you will. He thought there's a, he's more like a Newtonian, just a God that created but backed off from the world. That really threw me for a loop, because I was a Christian, I worked in science, and I never thought about that. So I left UAB, went across the mountain to Samford, because Samford allowed me, they met my salary, and they said, you can do all the science and religion stuff you want. UAB would not allow me to research this. So one thing I learned very early on was randomness is constrained. It is incredibly difficult to find examples of pure chance or ontological randomness, ontological chance. That if you may know David Bartholomew, former president of the Royal Statistical Society in England. He's written a couple of books, God of Chance and God, Purpose, or Chance. When I first met him and talked with him, he was very convinced that atomic emissions was a good example of true, pure randomness, basically saying there are no, you don't necessarily have to have a cause for every effect. It's basically what he's saying. There's no way to predict, never, nor will it be any way to predict, for example, when an atomic particle emits. So, but he's even recanted that now. He doesn't think there's anything as pure chance or ontological randomness. Do constraints on chance occurrences in evolution result in a set of boundary conditions that actually enable some level of predictability from a system generally viewed by scientists as incorporating any number of purely aleatoric features? That's basically the question that's driving this project. There's several lifetimes of work that can be done in this area, and we're just trying to kick it off in our university. Ours is a search for empirical evidence that supports or refutes the specification of quantitative factors underlying convergent evolution and or self-organizing behavior in the natural world. So we're basically taking some of the, they would not like me to express this, but Ulanowitz and Morris and Kaufman are in many ways philosophers as much as they are scientists. And so they do a lot of philosophizing. We're doing strictly empirical work on this. So from the secular side, this same work's been talked about over in Oxford, and we've got a presentation taking place at the Joint Statistical Meetings next week in Boston. We can look at it purely scientifically or secularly, and we can look at it from a theological perspective. We're doing the latter. But right now, all we've got is the empirical results. So I'm going to give you our theological and philosophical objectives in this study, although we don't really start them until now. This summer, we're beginning to, our theologians kind of getting hip deep in all of this. These are our scientific or mathematical objectives, to demonstrate the evolution of different types of useful neural circuits capable of solving increasingly complex problems. What I'm going to show you today are the result of evolving simple creatures, if you will. This coming year, we're going to increase the complexity quite a bit. To show how circuits evolved to solve one problem might be utilized in a larger circuit evolved to solve a more difficult problem, or used for an entirely different function. We can point to many examples, and we're talking simulations here, and simulations have their limits, and I'm going to even put a couple of those up on the slide in a minute. We've got a lot of examples of simulated creatures ending up at the same place and following completely different routes to get there, but which supports Kaufman's ideas of convergence. To show that constrained randomness in the evolution of circuits such as these leads to predictable qualitative results. To identify the role of different random factors on the evolution of specific circuits, not only how often, but on what time schedule can we expect certain results to occur. That's primarily what I've been involved with and what I'm going to talk to you a little bit about today. And to discover underlying statistical and mathematical relationships that make meaningful quantitative prediction possible. I'm an applied statistician. We've hired a theoretical mathematician who's going to try to find some closed form solutions of some of the problems that we have. We're hoping to come up with a theory of self-organizing behavior. The theological philosophical objectives: to use the qualitative results of our simulations to provide a proof of concept for the power and predictability of constrained randomness. And constrained randomness, again, is just, it could be environmental boundaries that are set, it could be climatic, it could be anything at all, but randomness is almost always constrained by something. To use the quantitative results of the simulations to consider the extent to which God might or might not have exerted control over the evolutionary process. Consider in the light of our results arguments that evolution is something we should have expected from God. To explore the implications of constrained randomness on theistic responses to transhumanism. I was real interested in David's talk on transhumanism as part of a grant that starts next month. In the spring of 16, we're going to be sponsoring an international conference on transhumanism at Samford, which will produce an edited book, we hope. We, just as an aside, in our center, we have two objectives. We have research, one prong, and we have education, the other prong. We've been in the churches around Birmingham and actually all over Alabama doing a series of lectures on the big questions in science and religion, because we think the people in the pews are ignorant of this, and if they thought evolution was hard to deal with, why do they see transhumanism coming along? So we want them to be literate on the issues related to things like transhumanism. And we also are working with the pastors. We're holding a lot of workshops for pastors over the next year as part of this new grant to try to familiarize them with some of the issues of science and religion. To consider, in the light of our results, arguments that evolution is something we have... To explore the implications of constrained randomness, theistic responses to transhumanism, and to use our work to help bridge the gap between competing views of creation, including those within religious communities. So those, I'm kind of out of place here today because I don't have a lot of theological or philosophical arguments to make, but that's what we're going to be doing over the next year, and I hope I'll be back next summer to maybe present on this side of it. Steve Donaldson has been working on a simulated evolutionary system for probably 6 years now. I have to believe it's probably the most sophisticated by a long shot of anything that's out there. You may or may not be familiar with the scientist at Michigan State University, Lenski. They even got a publication in Nature about a simulation that they created called Avida. And he's also done natural work with E. coli bacteria. I think he's up to 60,000 generations he's followed of a strain of E. coli, studying evolution and whether certain things are possible or not. These are 19 variables that are built into our simulation. They're all probabilistic in the sense that these are set randomly, basically, by the system itself. And these up here are set by the researchers, and not meaning to be sacrilegious here, but basically we're God in this scenario. So oftentimes they're randomly set, but we do the picking. The software does the picking for the probabilistic mutation operators. So it's a pretty complex system. In fact, it's a very complex system. And that's the other disclaimer I forgot to make. I'm a statistician. I'm not a theologian, and I'm not a computer scientist or a cognitive scientist. So when we get to the Q&A, I may not be able to answer some of your questions. I'll just be honest with you. So I don't know how well you can see this. What we did for our first year study was, we did more than this, but what we're reporting now are 12 different scenarios for running an evolutionary simulation. They include things like mutation rate. This one that we highlighted here, run 4, is basically baseline to compare everything else to. And the baseline's just arbitrary. There's nothing special about that run. But it had a low mutation rate. It had no elitism. What elitism simply means, they don't say the best simulated creature is not saved for the next generation. Now, if you have elitism, you pass the best member survives into the next generation and starts evolving with that population. We use different population sizes, 100, 20, 500. We looked at 2 appendage, 4 appendage, 6 appendage, and 8 appendage creatures. And I'll show you a little diagram of one. It doesn't actually look like this on the computer, it's all numbers, but it give you a sense of what we're after. And they're trying to reach an optimal fitness, a fitness target that we've taught. Here's an idea of what a six appendage one would look like if you were to draw it out. What we were after was starting with pure randomness, in a sense, except for the constraints. We tried to evolve, say, a six-legged or appendaged creature that would move in a straight line. So it's like a prey-predator kind of thing. It could evolve. We had runs that incorporated, let it freely run to create two appendages, four appendages, six appendages, or eight appendages. And we have other runs that just designated two appendage little creatures. So basically what you have is there's the linear body, and these are muscles, 0, 1, 2, 3. One is an agonist, one is an antagonist, where one makes it go back, the other makes it go reset. And the idea is to get these all synced up and going straight. I'll mention something we did later with this that I thought was kind of interesting as a statistician. This is basically a real brief summary of the results. What we did was we would set generation cutoffs. So with this one, for example, R06, we would allow it to go through 150,000 generations and see how many it created with, say, two of them, eight appendages. You'll notice, well, you won't notice on this slide, sorry. There's 80% of these that did not reach the target fitness level. But if you go back to the first run here, where we had only two appendages, one of those were two, all of them reached target. So what I wanted to point out today was something that I'm embarrassed to say as a statistician, I did not really know. This is an example of the very first run involving little things with two appendages. That's a dot plot. There were only 130 runs. That's how the number of generations of target fitness plotted out. Meaning, surrogate for time, number of generations. How many generations it took to evolve creatures with a certain level of fitness. What we found out early on was that they're log normal. Not only are they log normal, they're way log normal. And a log normal distribution is simply a skewed distribution with a tail to the right, where it's defined to be basically a set of numbers or distribution of numbers that if you take the log of those numbers, that distribution will be normal. That's all we're talking about. As a statistician in the biological sciences for years, I don't know how many times I transformed data for people because they come in, they want to do a simple t-test comparing distributions across two populations or two groups, and the data would be skewed, and that would mess up. That violates one of the assumptions of a t-test, and they would have run it themselves and come over to me and say, this has got to be significant. This difference has got to be statistically significant. What's going on here? Well, we do a log transform on their data, it normalizes it, and you see the difference. The thing was, what I never did was to back transform the data from logarithmic to the original scale. So this is a log normal that fits the distribution there. I don't expect you, if you can even see this, I don't expect you to think about it. This, since I had Parkinson's, I figured this is a study done in 2014, this year, just published. What I had never paid attention to as a statistician was, look at the duration of the disease of the people that they looked at. Had a mean of 6.3 plus or minus a standard deviation of 5.1. Okay. If you want to find out how many of those observations fell within 95% of the mean, you would go two standard deviations out, right? Well, what's that take you to? If you go two standard deviations out from either side of 6.3, if you talk about the standard error and the mean as well, you get a set of limits that make no sense because you can't have a shorter duration of the disease than zero. And yet our interval goes from 3.8 to 3.9 to 16.5. I knew this happened in medical work because you go get a blood test and they do a panel of like 12 or 18 different things with your blood. Well, I've known for years that those are always correlated. And so what happens is the chance that you commit a type 1 error, you have a false positive, is way, way up. And then they have to bring you in to make sure that that's okay, and then they find out it's okay. So we waste a lot of money in medicine retesting people because we don't set normal limits right. Most of the clinical measures that you have, like albumin level, cholesterol, are skewed. They're log normal. And yet they set the normal limits for medical testing using standard normal theory. So anyway, I realized we need to be back calculating in these things. And I don't know if you can see this little sign. It's X slash. That's a time sign and that's a divide sign. It's analogous to plus minus. It's times divide. So what we're learning so far about this is pretty obvious, I think, to most of you. These processes in evolution, if evolution exists and if it's out there, we're trying to provide evidence one way or the other, are generally log normal, and they're multiplicative in nature, meaning they represent a lot of interaction in nature. You don't pick up the multiplicative nature or the interactive nature in a lot of studies. We are here, and if you've got to have A and B and C and D and E all interacting together in the environment, by necessity, you're not going to have a symmetrical distribution. You're going to have a log normal. So we started looking around, and if you construct the 95% limit using that, here's what you get for this data: 1.1 to 21.1, and that makes more sense. And it actually accurately calculates the central 95% under the log normal distribution. So the first thing I realized as a statistician was, wow, I've been doing things wrong all these years, sort of. Just doing it 32 years, at least I learned it before I died. Real quickly, this shows you the difference between the additive model, which most people would use, and the multiplicative model. And if you look at it, you'll see that all the means are greater than the standard. All the means are greater than the median, which implies a skewed distribution to the right. And the takeaways from this first project are distribution of time to reach target, that is, the number of generations, is consistently log normal. This points to an underlying multiplicative or interactive process, which is more realistic than most people approach processes like this with. The larger population mean fewer generations needed to target fitness, reach target fitness, and more sources of randomness, more appendages, elitism, and high mutation rate in each generation increases the number of generations to target. So that's basically it. Like I said, we'll start the second part, which focuses more on theology, we started it. We started it this summer, and we'll see what happens. But we're really looking for support or something to refute self-organization and that sort of thing with. Any questions?
Well, first, thank you. So I think in the back, we had a question on the way.
I'm a geologist, and I don't. I understand you do incredibly valuable work, and I understand its value a little bit. Here's a question in terms of Gould's comment: if you ran the tape over, it would be very different. As a statistician, reaction to that: do you think it would be very different, or do you, at this point, today, do you think it would probably be virtually the same?
I'll be completely honest with you. Before we started this project, and I hadn't really thought about it too much, I would have said I'd probably side with Gould.
It would probably look different.
Yes.
Right?
Having seen what I've seen so far, I mean, simulations have lots of flaws, and that's definitely true. But I'm convinced this simulation is a lot better than most. It's very clear that there's convergence.
Right.
And we've got another paper that's getting submitted to the journal Artificial Life. I should have copied the graphic. There's a graphic that shows several evolutionary pathways, all reaching the same conclusion, but they follow different paths. And so we see that all over the place, getting the same result from different process.
Same end result.
About a week ago, I heard Simon Conway Morris, and he used that word convergence. What does it mean?
Basically, you've got two different evolutionary strains, independent of one another. Maybe he uses a lot of bird examples. He follows them around the world. And basically, they end up developing the same crop or some aspect of their body through different pathways. They started out as much different than what they end up. They end up a lot more similar than they started.
Yeah, you'd expect.
Yeah.
Is there a question? Yes. Yes. The woman in the green. Yeah. You go ahead.
So first question. I don't know what transhumanism is. You said you did a theistic response to transhumanism.
Transhumanism is the idea of the melding of silicon beings with organic carbon beings, basically. For example, if I make it long enough, I might get a deep brain stimulator put in, which will help with my Parkinson's symptoms. That would be an example of transhumanism. So under my skin now, I've got a little pacemaker-like device and some probes going down into my brain, and it makes me a better person physically than I was before I got it. Planting a microchip in a brain, there's been some work over in England by a guy named Warwick at the University of Reading, I think, where he's actually planted little circuit boards in the brains of some people that have pretty serious quadriplegia, and he can actually get them to move. So the idea that maybe you go blind, they could just give you artificial eyes. And the big question with transhumanism is what does it mean to be human? You know, when do you cross a line that you're actually now more silicon or more,
So you had a second question as well, and then Don, right?
Thank you so much, sorry. My second question is, surely what's actually doing constraining is the environment. It's varying environment, it's changing, it's geographically different. And isn't that enough to generate what we see on Earth?
I don't know. I can't answer that question. I see where you're coming from on that.
We're evolving to fit niches, aren't we? We survive in.
Yeah. It's, you know, if you have a mutation to a polar bear that the offspring comes out with no fur.
We don't need to have an extra kind of physical thing that's guiding it, do we? I mean,
well,
that's constrained by saying it's got to be able to do this goal.
That's our bias. I mean, I have to admit, I mean, in science, we're supposed to go towards things objectively. But that's our bias. That basically evolution is underdetermined by that there's more out there that hasn't been accounted for that caused evolution, if you believe in evolution to be the origins of species.
So I'm going to take Don's question.
I'm not very familiar with these algorithms, nor could I tell what you're thinking about your algorithms, so let me ask you this way.
I'm not either.
Skeptics tell them that often people build in the ends in the algorithms in some way, and I was wondering if you had a discussion with skeptics and what the outcome of those is.
Yeah, now we have. One of those limitations I had up just a second ago, I think, addressed that. Predictability is built into the simulation system. True of the Earth, too, in that it has provided relatively stable and predictable environments. That's what the biologist consultant we're working with makes the argument that evolution couldn't have taken place on Earth unless there were some fairly stable conditions for it to happen in. So that may not be as serious a concern. We actually brought the concern up. It's an obvious one.
And it also has to be the rules that go from one.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
So, Philetta has a question. I think we probably should then go on to the panel and take other questions for later. So, Philetta.
Thank you. I'm wondering if any simulations you started it off in Harvey Weinberg equilibrium. And I also wondered if you used Hotchkiss duplication to mimic Hotchkiss.
Yeah, what we did, that's one of the last things we did, and it's not reported up here. Gene duplication brought the time to evolve way down. It probably had the biggest impact of anything we've done. We added gene duplication to the algorithm. So yeah, it had a major effect on how long, number of runs.
All right, let's thank Tom once again.